Welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast series by Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm Giuseppe Porcaro, and today we will start a conversation about the skills which are needed for the jobs of the present and the future, which will continue in a series of other episodes in the months to come. Joining me for this discussion are El Issa Mohamedou, head office at the OECD Center for Skills, and Dugu Gunnar, who is our fellow here at Bruegel, working on future work and inclusive growth issues. El Issa and Dugu, thanks a lot for joining The Sound of Economics. I would like to remind our listeners that this episode is part of our series linked to the Bruegel Research Program on the future work and inclusive growth. I would like to give a little bit of an introduction to the issue we want to discuss today. So having a workforce with the skills that are in demand contributes to sustainable growth, leads to more innovation, and improves companies' competitiveness. The European Commission has dedicated 2023 as its European Year of Skills, and the stated goal to give fresh impetus to lifelong learning, empowering people and companies to contribute to the green and digital transitions, as well supporting innovation and competitiveness. In the words of Commission's President Ursula von der Leyen, the best investment in our future is the investment in our people. Skills and education drives Europe's competitiveness and innovation, but Europe is not yet fully ready.
To address this issue, here at Bruegel, we are launching a podcast mini-series on skills. In this series, we discuss how we can utilize upskilling and reskilling initiatives to protect vulnerable groups of the workforce, how to build a resilient workforce, and create a better functioning EU labor market.
To kick off our discussion, I would like to ask both of you to give us an overview about why are we speaking about skills and why this matters from the perspective of the workers, the institutions, and the employers alike. I don't know who would like to start, but the ball is yours.
Okay, so maybe I take the start and quickly give an introduction of why we care about skills. I think we all agree that the labor markets are undergoing a significant transformation due to new technologies like AI and automation, but also because of the demographic and environmental shifts we are experiencing in the recent years, and it will also only increase in the future. So these rapid advancement of digital transformation and emerging technologies are leading to swift changes in the skill set required in many sectors. While these technologies are replacing some jobs traditionally done by humans, they're also transforming the nature of work. So a recent research by World Economic Forum estimates in 2027, 43% of tasks will be completely performed by machines, while today the number is 34%. The same report also envisions that 44% of workers' core skills are going to be changed in the next 5 years. This gives an idea of the magnitude of the shift we need in the skill composition of our workforce. As a result, these changes are affecting both the types of available jobs and the skills required to perform them as well. And this presents an opportunity as well as challenges. From the workers' perspective, I think it's easy to see why we care about skills. Like having the right skill set is going to have a significant impact on individuals' prospects, like career opportunities, job security, and earning potential. And to remain competitive in the job market, workers need to continually develop and update their skills to meet changing demands of the economy. It can also help them to adapt changing job requirements and new technologies, making them overall more resilient against the economic disruptions and job market fluctuations. From an employer's perspective, you actually summarized already, but I will just quickly go over it again. Having a skilled workforce is crucial in maintaining competitiveness, and it's one of the main drivers of innovation, and it helps us to guarantee product and service quality. Without access to suitable labor force, achieving these objectives can be challenging, if not impossible. So this is why skills are hot topic at the moment. But also from the perspective of the governments and civil society, this high importance assigned to skills provides many opportunities, and I would like to quickly touch upon that as well. So to have adequately skilled workforce and an economy free from labor shortages is, of course, contribute to economic growth, but this is not why skills matter. So in the past, obtaining a good formal education was considered to be the primary means of securing a good job and hence was key to social mobility. But a good formal education was not always accessible to everyone. Financial barriers, social inequalities, geographical location, discrimination, these type of problems were restricting access to quality education for many. However, as companies increasingly face skill shortages, they shift towards hiring practices that prioritize skills over formal degrees. And this creates opportunities for disadvantaged groups of society for whom a good formal education was not accessible in the past. So this is why governments and civil society organizations choose recognize the importance of skills as a means to promote social mobility, inclusion, and diversity. So maybe Eliza wants to add something, so I talked a bit too much.
Sure. Hard to add much on this. It's extremely comprehensive, Duguay. Perhaps just to backtrack and look into what we mean when we talk about skills. At the OECD, we define skills as foundational. So we're looking at literacy, numeracy, digital skills, transversal cognitive and metacognitive skills. So it's really looking at critical thinking, complex problem solving, creative thinking, but also socio-emotional skills, empathy, self-efficacy, collaboration, and technical skills. So those that are needed for the specific occupations. And all these skills matter, and I think that's an important element. Duguay, you mentioned it, skills investment certainly drive competitiveness, innovation, equity. And there's lots of numbers out there about what that means. The World Economic Forum, for example, calculated a couple of years ago that bridging the current skills gaps could add $6.5 trillion to global GDP by 2030. And we, the IMF, the ILO, have similar projections. So skills are really an essential economic investment. But skills are also a collective evolving resource that gets developed and replenished through interactions at the workplace and outside of it for individuals. And that's essential because most jobs, as Duguay mentioned, are undergoing radical changes because of the digital and green transitions and so on. And so we really need to ensure that individuals are also ready for these changes. And I think that's also why we're talking about this.
Maybe we can say a little bit more about these needs that are new. I mean, especially when it comes to digitalization and the transition to a low carbon economy, what kind of skills we are referring to when we refer to these two transitions specifically, and how different they are from what we needed in the past.
So these are specific technical skills that are related to the introduction of green technology. So for instance, those that are used by wind turbine service technicians or solar photovoltaic installers or recycling technicians. But they're also the other cognitive, management, social skills, communication, teamwork, organizational skills, all these transversal skills that are also part of the skills set of low carbon jobs. And again, this is important because we're expecting a large job creation actually due to this transition. And just to cite one number, the ILO, for instance, estimates that there should be a net job creation of 25 million jobs through the green transition by 2030. So those are really the kind of skills we're talking about.
Duguay, do you want to add something on that?
Maybe one thing I would like to add also, you will see that the importance of technical skills are diminishing over time, and we are more and more emphasis is given to soft skills like analytical thinking, creative thinking, even empathy and active listening are really high on demand skills. And so maybe this would be one of the aspects which was different few decades ago, where technical skills had a higher wage premium. But of course, this does not mean that there are new technical skills emerging, which are like AI and big data, and these are, or design and user experience. These are going to be maybe new technical skills we will need in the next 5 to 10 years.
Well, this seems to entail also a change in the way vocational education and training systems, and beyond that, recruitment mechanisms and on-the-job trainings are going to be conducted. And we hear a lot that to face the challenges of these transitions, people need to equip themselves to reskilling and upskilling. Those kind of two words are becoming buzzwords in those circles. And maybe, Dugo, you can explain our listeners what exactly do we mean by those terms and how do we get there?
Of course. So actually, although they sound very similar and they are referring to more or less the same concept, they are actually different terms and there's a nuance. So upskilling implies learning relevant new skills to complement and supplement the existing skill set in the current job, while reskilling is learning new skills to replace the existing skill set. In that sense, upskilling enables people to be more productive in the current job or like catch up with the changes in the task description, but reskilling actually enables cross occupation mobility for workers. So how do we get there is actually a very big topic, and hopefully we will have an idea by the end of this talk, and hopefully the year of European Year of Skills will help us a bit direction to get there.
Elisa, do you have a take on that?
Yeah, so I'm actually glad you mentioned vocational education and training. So at the OTD Center for Skills, we certainly think that this is one of the most important and efficient areas to help us with this green transition we're just talking about, and what Doug, you just mentioned about upskilling and reskilling processes in general. And so one of the main challenges we face is that most people who have access to training don't actually take it up. So on average across the OECD countries, 6 in 10 adults did not participate in any form of adult learning in the 12 months. And out of the 6 who did not participate, 5 reported not being willing to take part in available opportunities. And in Europe, it's a similar level, with only 37% of adults who undertake training on a regular basis. So, and there are also stark inequalities in those with socioeconomic backgrounds who participate even less. So if we're going to have to prepare young people to the new world of work, we need to ensure they acquire a growth mindset from an early age. And if we're to ensure that adults acquire the new skills that Dugu was talking about needed in these changing jobs, then we need to make sure that training programs are flexible as well in terms of time constraints, family obligations, and so on, that they're short and affordable, and that workers are well informed as well about the learning opportunities. It also means a strong collaboration between schools and vocational professionals to identify and reformulate as well the school curricula to provide both the foundational and up-to-date learning for the current and the future labor market. So, and on all these fronts, VET is really very well placed.
Thank you. I would say that lifelong learning as well becomes another element in this puzzle, right? Alongside vocational training and out-of-school training. But what we really speak about here is that the learning process is not anymore just a nice add-on to people's career, but a feature that should be really embedded in the cycle. Is that correct?
Yes, it is correct, because like now more than ever, the tasks are changing very fast. So the nature of jobs are changing that in a way that we haven't seen before. And it's impossible to know how the exact nature of labor demand will be in the next few years even. So in such a setting, it is more important than the workforce itself has this lifelong learning mindset that enables them to gradually realign with the labor demand. So in that sense, lifelong learning is no longer a nice add-on, but it's a like compulsory part of our vitality in the labor force, let's say. It is a must-have now.
But on the other side, there is also a call to align the formal education system with skills demand. And I would like to be a little bit provocative here, because I ask myself, you, and perhaps the listeners themselves to reflect whether we should not instead think about the fact that formal education alone cannot meet the demands of these new needs. this rethinking of the learning brings us to rather look into a complementarity of formal education with non-formal education as an important part of seeing the evolution of the skilling path, like an holistic view on what it means to learn the skills. Elisa, how do you see the role of non-formal education to provide the skills we are talking about, especially the soft skills which are needed in the job market?
So certainly on the job, learning, for instance, is essential. So, and we have enough research that shows that people learn best when they are active, not passive observers of what is taught. And people learn best when they're engaged in the material, when the information is meaningfully connected to their knowledge. So they learn best in social context, actually, when there are in peer relationships, when the information is iteratively presented multiple times in different ways. And frankly, the skills in demand by today's employers don't always require years of studies. Workshops, short programs, or even voluntary work can equip learners with skills to work in specific fields. Micro-credentials are also an important element in the skilling path that you mentioned. And if they are of quality, if they're focused on applied knowledge that can be used in the labor market, if they're recognized and valued by the employers, if they're stackable so that one can add on to them as you advance in specific learning needs. So all of this is important. And it's also important to remember that most of the learning actually happens outside of the formal setting. So, and in this world where we face with constant change, I think the front load learning with our current model of studying many years for a degree and then going out to build a career is not going to work anymore. People will have to keep learning while earning. You have to keep going back to relearn and reskill, and you have to adapt constantly and pivot and change jobs. So continuing skilling will be done also in many different places and in many different ways, both online and offline, on campus and at the workplace. And that also means that we need to make sure that the recruitment processes not only focus on academic credentials, but hire based as well on these skills. And in some countries and sectors, we're advancing really well with this skills-based hiring, which is gaining really a lot of momentum, and which, by the way, would also help in improving socioeconomic diversity in recruitment.
Hugo, do you want to add something on the role of non-formal education and also of non-formal education providers, I would say, that sometimes they are not the kind of actors we think about? And I'm thinking here about youth organizations who are doing this kind of work on the grassroots level, and that they need always a recognition comparing to the formal education setting or the on-the-job, more like corporate kind of skilling, processing, and so forth.
Currently, the majority of non-formal trainings is still provided by the employers. So in that sense, learning is still, to a bigger extent, limited in the workplace.
No, maybe I was not very clear about my question, because actually the biggest provider of non-formal educations are youth organizations. So you have like big organizations like the World Organization of the Scout Movement and the organizations who are providing non-formal education worldwide. They are not necessarily recognized by the employers sometimes, and they also struggle in order to have the value of their educational programs to be recognized. So what I'm trying to push here, both of you, is like this conversation would be incomplete if we don't put into the picture the other providers, NGOs, and so forth, and how they should work within this constellation with the employers and with the public institutions and so forth. How can we create a virtuous circle of the resources that we have?
So the biggest problem with this is that this training provided by these third-party organizations, NGOs, is not recognized. But for that, actually, now one of the main policy areas that is focusing on the skill issue is recognition of skills and promotion of micro-credentials. So I think the year of skills also provides this opportunity to create collaborations and cooperations between NGOs and the institutions who issue those certificates, micro-credentials. So it could generate an opportunity for them to collaborate. But honestly, I'm not aware of any ongoing work there, how the services of these third-party organizations could be structured and recognized and validated. This is not an area I'm familiar with. Maybe Eliza has something to chip in there.
So I think the point where Dugu mentioned, it's really about the validation and the recognition of those skills that are acquired outside. So that's one thing. It's not just a question of qualifications in terms of recognition, but it's also ensuring that the employers are comfortable recruiting on that basis. Because until now, they have, of course, followed the model where they have been recruiting based on academic qualifications, which is a setup they're familiar with. And so, of course, now moving into other types of credentials, it means also we need to make an effort so that they have a setup where they feel comfortable recruiting on this basis. And so I think absolutely right. It is a paradigm shift. And human resources in a lot of companies are really struggling still to see how do we incorporate and how do we hire based on skills now rather than just academic qualifications. And that's already happening in some larger companies. The main issue will be now to trickle this down also to small and medium enterprises.
I want to be a little bit more provocative again. And we are speaking quite a lot about providing the right skills for the jobs. But somehow formal schools, university, even post-grad curricula, they are really not meant just to provide skills for jobs. They are meant to provide general culture, critical thinking, in-depth knowledge, and last but definitely not least, forming good citizens. Aren't we reducing the importance of education to only one dimension, which is about finding a job?
So I completely agree. I think education's outputs are the workforce inputs, but that's not the only purpose of education. So education and training are not just a conduit for the labor force. The skills gained there are applicable to the rest of life. And actually, our work at the OECD shows that better educated and trained individuals enjoy healthier lives. They are better informed citizens. They're more engaged in society. So, for example, a 25-year-old university educated man can expect to live almost 8 years longer than his lower educated peer on average across OECD countries. And that difference is also similar with women with 4.6 years. But it goes even beyond. And there's a saying, you know, of Nelson Mandela, who once said that education is the most powerful weapon you can use to change the world. And so in the world we're in with changes that are difficult to grasp nowadays with the pandemics and exponentially developing artificial intelligence, education and training will have even more of a role, not just respond to the changes in the world, but to actually shape it.
Honestly, I believe like the role of formal education is not really to provide these technical skills, but even more so the soft skills, like how to think critically, how to approach problems systematically. I think these are the main role why we have formal education, to embed this learning culture in kids, youngsters, because this is going to be the skills that we will need always. So these are not going to lose importance over time. These are not going to vanish. These soft skills are, I think this is why we rely on formal education to create this learning culture and working in teams, empathy, active listening. I think the role of formal education, I see more on the development of the soft skills rather than the technical skills, because technical skills, we all agree that now we don't need official degrees to signal that we have these technical skills, but rather we can have certificates, training courses here and there, micro-credentials. But the soft skills are more important, as we also see in the research showing that the importance of soft skills are going nowhere. They will be important in the next 10 years also.
The other big challenge here is then how to remove the obstacles to such training for all these skills that are needed. Which can be the policy recommendation that you would like to propose? Thinking, Eliza, about what the OECD is proposing, but obviously also Dugu in the frame of the project that we are conducting at Bruegel.
First, it's really about identifying which skills are necessary for the next stage in a worker's career. So people will only undertake training if they're convinced of its need and its usefulness in their career. Then it's about addressing the barriers to their participation in training. So, for example, allowing training leave and modular training offers so people who are short on time or have family obligations can engage in them. Helping individuals navigate the variety of training choices through public employment services, career guidance, but also offering, of course, financial aid for direct costs like course fees and indirect costs like childcare to engage the lower skilled and the lower paid adults, but also ensuring there is cooperation among all the stakeholders, including governments, workers, and enterprises in every step of this process. That's really something we engage very much with at the OECD. It's important, for instance, to strengthen training led by enterprises like apprenticeships. SMEs, I was mentioning earlier, will need support assessing the skills gaps and identifying the relevant trainings and finding ways to sometimes provide it as well in collaboration with others to reduce the costs. Worker representatives also have an important role in engaging lowest skills and the oldest workers. And employers also need to be consulted when curricula and occupational standards are set or are revised, and industry-specific experience is also important and for teachers in some fields. So we should really look into, from our side, is these collaborations. And for me, they're really at the center of the policy recommendations.
I totally agree with Eliza on the barriers to training and that we should first identify the skills and then tackle the barriers towards those skills. So, but one thing maybe from the data I should add on that, because when we see that certain demographic characteristics bring some certain barriers, like women are more prone to participate training because of family responsibilities, age and health-related problems are hindering older workforce from training participation. But what we see that low-educated people have also a lesser access to training in general. The reasons they are stating as a barrier are thus like not meeting the prerequisite to training, not having access to infrastructural needs, let's say, and having negative previous learning experience. So to enable an inclusive shift in our skill composition, I think we shouldn't be overlooking the big group of people who are not really skilled, who don't have high returns to skilling, who don't have the incentives, the time, the financial resources to invest in training. And in the current setting, while the employers are mostly paying for training, there is no way that disadvantaged groups of the society will have access to training. And this is why it is important that the public sector is more involved in financing and provision of training to these most vulnerable, most disadvantaged groups of the society. So currently we have like the European Council is publishing recommendations on individual learning accounts or micro-credentials. And these policy tools are tackling important barriers to training. But as Eliza already mentioned in the beginning of our talk, is still the big chunk of people are not participating in training because they don't have a motivation to participate. So we don't know the real reason behind this lack of motivation. It could be previous negative learning experiences, as it is the case with low educated people. It could be shame, but we don't really have the data tackling and showing us the magnitude of this overlooked problems. So I think it is important to broaden our set of barriers a bit and also include social, psychological barriers to training if we are aiming to, as the World Economic Forum envisions, like 44% of the workforce has to change their core skill set, then we definitely have to be reaching a bigger set of the workforce with these training initiatives.
Yeah, absolutely. You're right, Dugu. And because we are going towards the end of this episode, on what you're saying, I would like to look a little bit ahead into the future. Since we've been starting with the mention of the European Year of Skills and the overall objectives fleshed out by the president of the European Commission and so forth, what would make you rate the European Year of Skills a success, according to you? How we can, in a year from now, basically judge the year we are in order to say that in all the things that you've been discussing today, some advancement could make some step forward.
So I hope we can really increase the awareness of the importance of skills. Understanding usually precedes action. So the more we can this year talk about skills and dissect the challenges, share best practices, the more we'll be able to take action. So, and that's essential at the EU level, particularly with the goals that have been set by its member states, whether it's that 60% of adults are in training per year by 2030, or that at least 80% of all adults should have at least basic digital skills by the same year. So we can't predict the future, but we can try to prepare for it in the context of lifelong learning and improving equity. So I really hope we can raise awareness about these issues in this year.
So Commissioner Niklas Schmidt described the European Year of Skills as a catalyst for skills revolution that is needed in Europe. And I totally agree with him. I believe that this initiative is not merely a symbolic gesture for a single year, but rather an opportunity to generate cooperations and momentum among various stakeholders towards this continuous skill development movement. So as Satya Nadella puts it, the learn-it-alls does it better than the know-it-all. And now we really need those who learn it all. So I think European Year of Skills is our chance to build the structures that would foster a culture of lifelong learning. And it's a great opportunity. I hope we can use it to the maximum as much as possible. So I'm very enthusiastic and excited about the year ahead.
And I think on this very positive note about learning it all, I think that it's a very good note for closing our conversation for today. We could discuss for much longer, but this is all the time we have for this episode. But we will continue our conversation on skills with Dugu, especially in the frame of our Bruegel project. And we will touch some of the points we've discussed today in more in-depth in some future episodes of our podcast. I would like to remind everyone that this episode is part of Bruegel Research Program on the Future Work and Inclusive Growth. And that, as usual, you can all read in open access all the analysis by our scholars on our website, www.bruegel.org. Elisa, Dugu, thanks a lot for this conversation, and thanks for our listeners for following us. Until next time, bye-bye.
Thank you.